Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website RickAckerman.com. Rick, where are you speaking to us from today?
I'm in South Florida today. We're having our third day of on and off torrential downpours, still pretty hot.
Rick, the market, everybody's saying this could be a tough fall. Is it definitely a bear market, or are there still some surprises under the covers that could poke up and maybe shock some people?
I think the shock will be that we're not really going to get kind of a leveling off and a little bit of sideways. The market is really starting to come down. The weakness is apparent everywhere, and the surprise will be that we're going to see stocks accelerate to the downside. And I've been kind of reluctant to sound the all clear for bears because over the years, and I mean over the course of the bull market that began in 2009, I've been as bearish as anyone out there, but I've used a technical method that's at least kept me on the right side of the move. As bearish as I thought things looked for the U.S. and global economy, I was able to decouple that point of view, from the craziness of the markets. And, I've described how bear rallies eventually turn into true bull markets in minute detail, just to justify why when the market started looking really ugly last January, why bulls shouldn't lose hope. And not that I was trying to make bulls hopeful. I think that the market really needs to correct horrifically to set things right, to get the economy back in balance. So anyway, we've been coming down, 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 and I think it's going to get worse. We're really in the very early stages. And I've tried to describe in minute detail how these phony rallies work. You get the biggest cap stock in the world, Apple, probably the key bellwether on the planet for stocks. And when I say biggest cap, I mean it's the heaviest stock out there. It takes a lot of cash to lift it. But the sleazeballs who run the show, let's call it Wall Street, and its trade desk minions, the tactic they use to levitate Apple with almost no outlay of cash is to let it either waft higher overnight in very thin volume so that shorts get to their desks in the morning and I think, oh, my God, this stock's about to break loose. Or if there's weakness or selling or let's say ugly news out, they'll let the stock drop before the opening bell so that selling is depleted. You know, anybody wants to sell has a chance overnight, and they sell into nothing. There are no bids there, and the stock just drops. So in this situation, the opening bell is 5-10 minutes off, and the shorts realize there's no supply. So they start buying it like crazy, and the stock opens on a gap. So that's how you take a stock worth trillions of dollars, and you make it go up, 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 with no cash going into it. And Apple is so high visibility that when it moves, the rest of the stocks move. So you can essentially engineer a bull market with very little cash outlay. But what I've described, these are phony rallies. They're almost criminally phony. But if you do enough of them, you get Apple to a level. And Apple, by the way, came within 4% of hitting new all-time highs on this last rally. So you get things to go up, up, up. And pretty soon people start looking at the stock market and thinking, well, I guess the economy is not so bad after all. And this phony levitation of stocks engenders a psychological change that causes people to start consuming and borrowing again and to stimulate the economy. So that's how it works. And I never completely discounted the possibility that that could happen, no matter how grim the news. But now I think I can almost 100% discount it. I think we're in a real bear market. And as I said, the surprise is going to be how little respite we get from what is about to turn into a relentless downtrend.
When you're in a situation like that, can you look at major causes for the downturn? I know in Europe, with Russia choking off their energy supplies, they're going to be paying 1,000% more or something ridiculous like that for natural gas. Could the same thing happen to the U.S.? Will it be reflected this side of the Atlantic?
Well, in the many conversations we've had, I've always emphasized the opposite, that it's not things that cause the market to come down. The market comes down and it creates all the other changes in what you would call the real economy. It just changes psychology. People don't think expansively about money, about borrowing, you know, and of course the strong dollar, is making dollars harder and harder to repay. So we're really just, while people are so obsessed, focused on inflation, inflation is about to get slam dunked. You know, this inflation is not going to survive a recession, much less the very deep, maybe even depression that we're headed into. So, the inflation will prove to have been a transient phenomenon. And of course, in that view, interest rates are already plenty high. I mean, the market can get all head up about another 75 basis point increase, but rates are already high enough that they're going to turn killer when the underlying assets, meaning the collateral, starts decreasing in value. And a lot of that is invested in energy. You know, the oil fields, natural gas, inventory was collateral for quite a bit of leverage borrowing. And, that's going to shrivel up and turn into, a source of deflation before too terribly long.
Is there a way to make money in a market like that?
No. I mean, you can get short. Bears have been reluctant to do that because, the more of them that take that attitude, that then you finally do get these bear rallies. But I think, when you see the market go down pretty hard, it means there really weren't many bears getting short at the top because, they constitute buying power when things come down. When things come down hard, that means there really is no buying power. Especially the short covering kind. So I've never viewed the coming deflation as an opportunity to make money. You make money by leveraging things, and deflation at a global level now is fundamentally a deleveraging event. So if you're a genius, maybe you'll hold on to 20% of your current net worth. And you'll have that to deploy when things finally hit bottom and you can start buying things for 10 cents on the dollar. I keep telling my son that. He flips Supras. That's a Toyota that was made in the 1990s. It has been very collectible. And, you know, the prices have gotten as high as, hundreds of thousands of dollars, or even I think the Fast Infusion Supra sold for a couple million bucks. So he's been in just sort of trading him and flipping him, and he's got very lean inventory, and he says, oh, I can buy three cars anytime I want, and I know exactly where to lay them off. But he has no clue. He's never seen liquidity go to zero overnight, and that's what I've been trying to pound into his head, and I think he's finally got it. So I don't really see a lot of money-making opportunities in a deflation. It's going to be very hard to be short the market. And a lot of things, there's still some crashes left to go with some of the REITs, the real estate-involved REITs. The movie chains are all going to zero, the big chains, but they're already bankrupt, and so many of the good plays have been discounted. There's some things you can't short. You know, my friend of mine who lives in rural North Carolina just had a rent increase from $1,500 to $2,000 for a three-bedroom apartment. And to me, this says that the landlords still, they still don't get it. You know, they think that the very tight rental markets that's existed for the last few years is going to continue forever. But I think within 2 years, finding good tenants, meaning the few that are left who can still pay the rent, the tenants are going to be a premium and it'll be a buyer's market again.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, would gold be any kind of protection if there's a major market plunge?
Gold is always going to work, and I don't see – I've never been a gold 5,000-an-ounce person, let alone 50,000-an-ounce. And, you know, gold bugs are still suffering. It just, it's coming down. It just gets hit. Any rally – just it just sputters out, and we're coming down again pretty hard in gold. Eventually, the mining business will benefit from reduced production costs. The energy to get gold out of the ground will be less costly, and so will the labor. So that's, I think, a good thing for the mining industry, but it's still very labor and energy intensive. And I think I expect gold to hold its own in terms of purchasing power relative to any other asset you could possibly hold. So I don't see gold going to the moon. I'm certainly not an inflationist, let alone a hyperinflationist, but gold historically has done pretty well in deflationary times, meaning even though it may not be going bananas, it does hold its purchasing power and its relative value in comparison to other classes of investable assets.
The crude prices have been going down, but will that continue as Europe faces perhaps a very cold winter without a lot of available energy?
Well, you're talking about, demand. The demand arises mainly out of global production, most significantly from Chinese manufacturing. So China prices crude at the margin and energy, and of course you have whatever however desperate Europe is for natural gas this winter, there will be offsetting deflationary forces, and part of it really comes from the leveraging of financial instruments, let's call them derivatives, that was accomplished using oil as collateral, and the fact that so much of this paper was piled up on inflated energy assets that it almost ordains a deflationary future for crude.
The Fed seems very intent on raising interest rates, but the figures, again, they're basing all of their actions on lagging indicators like employment and the inflation numbers. So by the time that their rate equals inflation has actually dropped a lot more than people have officially recognized. Is that going to be the case? They're going to overshoot the target?
The Fed is always way behind the curve. And, the fact that the market freaked the other day because the August inflation number was high. And of course, the market doesn't freak over the number itself. It freaks over what it perceives will be the Fed's reaction. But the Fed has already overreacted. They don't need another 75 basis points to take this economy down. They probably don't know that. The market may save all the traders, investors who think the Fed's going to hike again. And if the market goes down another 1,000 points over the next week or so, the Dow, or more than that, the story will change. The headline will change about, well, maybe the Fed is having second thoughts. But we've had a couple of those bozos get right out front and say, hey, I'm just liking another 75 basis points. And it reminds me of Lyle Gramley back in 1990-91. He was a Fed governor, and he was always out there threatening this next rate hike. And the only thing I could think of at the time was, Lyle, sit down and shut up. The Fed ain't going to do nothing in the way of raising rates. And, of course, they never did from 1990 till, it ran for the next rate hike was, I don't even remember, it was more than a decade later. So yeah, the Fed's as tight as it needs, the interest rates are as high as they need to be. And if mortgage rates stay, let's say they came down to 4%, that would still represent a crushing burden if home prices are falling. You know, we don't care about nominal interest rates, if home prices are rising, but in an environment of, falling asset prices, falling home prices, if you get a 2% mortgage, I guarantee you, you'll get crushed if your home falls as it did in 2007 and 8.
In Canada, the Canadian Real Estate Association says home prices have already come down 22%. Any similar signs in the U.S.?
Wow. I've always predicted that residential would come down 70% and that second homes, vacation homes, would have taken 90% hit. And I still think that'll happen. We got halfway there in 2007 and 8, but amazingly, I couldn't have imagined this. The home prices reinflated so that they were higher than they were at that peak. So to me, that means we've got the next big dive that home prices take. We'll get the whole 70%, or actually a little more than that, because prices have gone well above where they were in the earlier episode. So I think we may, I'd say a 70%, I guess that's splitting hairs, but I do think we've got a correction of at least 70% from the top. And it's not all deflation related. There's a demographic component there, simply because the baby boomers have nobody to sell their homes to. The millennials can't afford them, and may not even want to live where those homes are, out in the burbs. And that was a natural reason for home prices to start coming down. All the baby boomers want to downsize, but there's nobody to pass on their homes to. So they are going to wind up leaving the homes to the kids who can't afford them. And because the kids won't afford to maintain them or pay taxes on them, it will destroy the tax base of municipalities across the country. So that's obviously a big deal.
I don't maybe a bit of a sidebar here. Locally at the Pacific National Exhibition, they always give away a home, say, worth $2 million. And I was thinking the property tax on that $2 million home, unless you're well off, you may not be able to afford the tax. So it's not really a house that's a prize. It's actually a burden.
Exactly. And yeah. And when you look, I don't think that all the millennials and the Gen, whatever they are, the Xers,
yeah,
they're not still all living with their parents and playing, video games in the basement, but they're certainly, they don't really have the affluence that the baby boomers achieve, much less the, what we call the greatest generation. So they won't be able to afford those houses, not to buy them, not to maintain them, and not to pay taxes on them. And that's going to have very serious consequences for, all the cities in this country and their budgets.
Now, when you and I were growing up as teenagers, we would fantasize about the muscle car that we wanted to buy and impress our girlfriends. Millennials and Generation Xers do not think about cars anymore. My friends who are 20 years younger don't own cars and said they never wanted to and they don't see any need to. Is that going to be a big blow to North American industry, which relies so much on the automobile?
Well, let me mention that one of the reasons that the younger people have lost interest in cars is not because they prefer to ride their bikes out in the snow or all four seasons. It's because cars were less affordable to them. But you're right. I mean, there's the muscle cars right now. You take a Chrysler Hemi or something, and it might go for $200,000 or $300,000 at auction. In 10 years, there are no buyers for that car. You won't be able to give it away. And I think that the baby boomers who are still buying them, maybe less frenetically than before, they kind of know that. But you know how it is, you know, when you were a teenager and you dreamed about having the whole, you know, the Hemi engine and turbo blower and everything else, you still want it real bad, and you get it because you can afford it. You got the bucks, so you say, screw it, I'll just buy it. But there is no buyer for that car, even just a couple years down the road.
Plus, the demand for, I know crude, they're saying it could go to $250, $300 a barrel because they're not encouraging exploration. Will there be that kind of demand for oil if people have switched to electric, or the fact that here in Vancouver, co-op ownership is the way to go for a car where you use it two or three times a month and share it with others?
I think that's coming, and it's not so much good common sense as just acceding to the fact that the standard of living is slipping everywhere. There's almost no aspect of your life that of our lives outside of our homes where we can't see this ebbing away of the good life. You know, part of it comes from, you can't find a clerk in a store anymore. And pretty soon there'll be no employees working in banks. That means they're going to have to close all the branches. You can't reach a human being on a phone at any company. And obviously it's not a question if there's not enough help. The work ethic has been lost. So, you know, those are all things that describe a shrinkage in the standard of living.
Also, the work ethic, this thing about quiet quitting, you come in exactly on time, do as little as possible, quit as soon as the clock hits 5 o'clock. If there's a project dangling halfway completed, in my lifetime, people my age, once you started working on something, you finished it. And I wasn't told to do that by my boss. It was just expected because you're a good employee. But then they started laying us all off when we hit our 50s because we were considered old and substandard somehow. And I said, those younger people don't have the experience to complete things quickly and efficiently. So you're going to need three of them to do the job that I did. And I can look back at my past employer, and that's exactly what happened. They had no idea that I was doing so many different assignments at the same time. And what's more, the people replacing me, they can't wait to quit and get out and hit the bar.
Well, you know, I am always become kind of a leitmotif for me to say when something fails to work, it's like, damn millennials. Millennials designed that building. Yeah. In San Francisco that is leaning a little bit. They designed the bolts that are in concrete on the new Bay Bridge cantilever span that are rusting away. And anything that doesn't work, any software app, I always say damn millennials, even though I've got two sons who are millennials, and I guess I look at them as the exceptions. But, and you think, well, you guys, you kids ought to get off your lazy asses and do some work. But ultimately, you have to realize that it's an economic calculation that they're making. So when you have this quiet, you know, the quiet quitting, that you just do the minimum, it's really because they're getting paid the minimum. They have no job security. The companies all suck. The companies don't treat people like human beings anymore. They're just automatons that they can swap in and out, and whose jobs are done mostly by these AI systems or whatever. It's like nobody's got a real job anyway. So the millennials look at that, and the reaction is kind of the these are the old Russian joke about the government. They pretend they're paying us, and we pretend we're working, and that's where we're going. We're really we're in a very similar place here in the USA. Oddly enough, having reached it by way of a nominally capitalist road, the pathway is capitalism, but we're in the same place the Russians were. You know, they pretend to pay us, and we pretend to work, and it's very serious. It's not like that trend is going to turn around. Certainly the colleges are not going to be much help turning it around until they start drawing a multitude of American students into the engineering, you know, the tech departments. But, you know, that ain't going very far. They're going to be essentially art history majors for certainly the rest of our lives, assuming that anybody can even afford college at some point. You know, the degrees will be sold online, and the colleges, even the Ivies, will move more and more toward, degrees that you can get online, and the degrees will be scaled according to which college you're talking about. So it's possible that Harvard may get $150,000 for courses that you take online, and with the payoff being a degree, and East Podunk U may give you the same degree, and who knows, maybe more knowledge for a lot less, for $10,000.
Well, they just did a story about how the U.S. News and World Report college rankings in the U.S. are bogus because Columbia, for example, one of its own professors said its numbers can't be this good. We don't put that much effort into that particular course. And so he crunched the numbers, and now Columbia says, well, we were using faulty data. And that college professor said, no, we call it cheating, and normally you'd be expelled for that. So you can't even trust the numbers coming out of the major universities about how valuable that particular degree is. They have a name, but it turns out there's nothing behind it.
Well, the degree essentially it doesn't reflect knowledge, it reflects access.
Yeah.
All right. And let's say if you're in the Harvard MBA program, you've surely got access. I mean, I'm reading about how some smart entrepreneur started, essentially renting yachts, and they just, the Ivy League, the MBA, candidates, they hang out on these boats in the Adriatic and just kind of network. And right now, I think it's almost exclusively the elite schools that are promoting these. The schools themselves don't promote the programs, but the students have certainly gone after them in a big way and don't mind paying a few thousand dollars to spend a week on one of these boats. So when U.S. News and World Report rates the colleges, who knows what the ratings mean? I mean, they're trying to be serious about it. But you can get an excellent education in a second or third or even a fourth tier school if there are a couple good professors and you're willing to work. So yeah, the rating system is kind of a fraud, but I think the students perceive the ratings in terms of access and of elite membership.
Yes, you join a fraternity at Yale, you got a better chance of becoming president than anything else.
That's true. I guess I can't remember how many Skull and Bones guys have been president, but it's certainly a good place to start.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, just to repeat something I said earlier, don't be surprised if this market doesn't like go down hard and not correct sideways for a while. I think it's really we're in the beginning of something that's going to turn into a little bit of hell.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Always a pleasure, Jim. I appreciate your inviting me on.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks. His website, rickackerman.com. You can find us on YouTube at Talk Digital Network. We're on BitChute at Talk Digital Network. You can also send comments or questions for our guests to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.